This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
The Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is case number appeal 31059, David Wedge versus Mid-Continent Media. Nathan Oviatt will be arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Wedge, and Bartholomew McLay will be arguing on behalf of the appellee, Mid-Continent Media. Each side will have 15 minutes for initial argument, and then Mr. Oviatt, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed, Mr. Oviatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Nate Oviatt, and I am privileged today to be representing David Wedge in the matter at bar. Mr. Wedge's story is a very important case for South Dakota workers' compensation law, and I'm humbled to tell it. There are three issues presented by this appeal. The first issue is a core issue and dispositive of the remaining issues. And that is whether the circuit court erred in declining to apply the doctrines of res judicata, judicial estoppel, and mend the hold to preclude consideration of a change in condition pursuant to SDCL 62-7-33. The second issue is framed in the alternative, and that is whether the circuit court and the Department of Labor erred in finding a change in condition under 62-7-33. And the final issue is whether the circuit court erred in determining that the Department of Labor committed harmless error in permitting insurer's biomechanical engineer to testify on medical causation. As I said, the first issue is one of jurisdiction and a core issue. It is also fully reviewable as a question of law. First, some background is necessary. This case began as a catastrophic work injury in 1991 to Mr. Wetch's cervical spine, which left him permanently and totally disabled. It left him with a fusion in his cervical spine, and more importantly, it left him with quadriplegia in all four limbs, his arms and his legs. It was not a relatively modest work injury as described by insurer in its brief. Even a cursory glance at the medical records in this case would confirm that. But it is after his injury, which is why we're here today, after Mr. Wetch's work injury, he began having difficulty with his workers' compensation insurer in providing the medical benefits required under South Dakota workers' compensation law. Ultimately, after a federal bad faith lawsuit, the 1991 work injury resulted in a 1994 settlement agreement between Mr. Wetch and his carrier, Crum & Forster. And in the settlement agreement, Crum & Forster agreed to provide the medical benefits owed under South Dakota workers' compensation law pursuant to SDCL 62-4-1. And for a period of time, that agreement held. Then in the early 2010s, new disputes arose. Ultimately, in 2014, Mr. Wetch filed a petition in the Department of Labor seeking an order from the Department of Labor demanding that the insurance company pay the medical benefits owed to Mr. Wetch under the 1994 settlement agreement. The results of this 2014 petition were four separate orders by the Department of Labor compelling insurer to pay the medical benefits prescribed by Mr. Wetch's doctor, Dr. Michael Goodhope, as required by the 1994 settlement agreement.
So those four orders that were entered that you're talking about, do you think those were final orders?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I think call versus benevolent order establishes that multiple final orders can exist in an administrative proceeding such as the Department of Labor. However, we have additional final orders to talk about.
So if I could, so this follows the, what was it, 2014 petition, right?
That's correct.
Which, as I understand it, remains unresolved.
The Department of Labor retained continuing jurisdiction, yes, Your Honor.
That was the whole purpose, as I understood Judge Viken's order, to stay the federal court's hand, remand or allow, not remand, but allow the administrative and state court review process to run its course before the bad faith case goes forward. So that's the 2014 petition. These orders that we're talking about, though, and the series of orders, those are all partial summary judgment, right?
That's correct.
Not complete summary judgment, so they're partial summary judgment, yes?
They're called partial summary judgment, but they fully resolve the issue of compensability.
Insofar as the issue went at that moment in time.
That's correct.
So, but that issue, or that, in fact, Judge Viken was a little critical, it seemed like. He sort of said, look, you can't hold off letting this, you know, leaving this undone, and leaving this unresolved. I want you to go resolve it. Critical may be harsh, and that may not be accurate. But if that is still unresolved, how are these orders final?
That's a great question. And I think the best way to look at it is if we look at the 2016 contempt proceeding from Judge Davis, because once again, the insurance company wasn't providing the benefits. And so once we have that contempt proceeding in front of Judge Davis in the Seventh Circuit, and particularly if we look at paragraph 15 of Judge Davis's order, and this goes back to Judge Viken's decision as well on record 550 of Judge Viken's decision, he talks about this contempt order. And he says about this order, it's irreconcilable with the positions that insurer is trying to take in this case and now has taken before the Department of Labor and the Circuit Court in this case.
So that would be judicial estoppel more so than res judicata?
That would be judicial estoppel, Your Honor. I would agree with that. And that is consistent with Hayes. So after we have the four motions for summary judgment, the four orders for summary judgment, and the two separate contempt proceedings, as you said, we commenced a complaint in federal court for bad faith. And it was as a result of this bad faith action that insurer raised for the very first time a fall that happened in April of 2010.
Is there a dispute when the insurer learned of that fall in 2010?
Well, there may be a dispute, Your Honor, but because the Circuit Court and the Department of Labor both found that the insurance or that Mr. Wetch had not committed fraud in not disclosing that fall to insure, it is a distinction without a difference as to whether there's a dispute.
Well, it might go to res judicata, though, if the insurer says, hey, we didn't know about this until such and such a date, they couldn't fairly litigate that issue, right?
I suppose that that would be true, Your Honor. However, we do have admissions by the insurer in 2018 on the fourth motion for summary judgment, as well as before Judge Davis on the second motion for contempt, whereby there is no dispute that the insurer was in possession of the medical records.
So you're saying at least by 2018, no dispute, the insurer knew about this?
Yes.
And maybe before, but at least by 2018.
That's correct. And there's no way of knowing, you know, when insurer had possession of these records and decided that they didn't indicate any sort of material injury to Mr. Wetch.
Let's talk about the preclusion doctrine, res judicata, two components, issue preclusion, claim preclusion under our state law. Issue preclusion, of course, would require more issue identity. The issue was actually litigated. Claim preclusion, maybe not so much. How does that map on to what happened here? Is this issue preclusion? Is it claim preclusion? Which and why?
Yes, Your Honor. It's classic claim preclusion, and that is what Judge Viken identifies it as, particularly with respect to Judge Davis's.
What was the issue, and how is it identical to an issue that's now being litigated?
The position taken, and again, if you look at paragraph 15 of the order, it says Judge Davis found, as a part of that contempt, that insurer admits that it owed 100% of the care to Mr. Wetch under the 1994 settlement agreement.
But the issue in the 33 proceeding, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but in the 62 7 33 proceeding is changed conditions. that may or may not warrant some sort of modification, reduction, elimination of, or increase in benefits. So how was, if it's issue identity, that issue has to be the issue that got litigated before in order for it to be precluded in a subsequent action. How is that this case?
Issue preclusion has to be have been an issue that was actually litigated.
Right.
Claims preclusion could be something that was litigated or could have been litigated.
Well, I thought you said it was issue preclusion.
I'm sorry.
Let's talk about claim preclusion. Okay. So it could have been litigated, but it was not.
That's correct, Your Honor.
When could it have been litigated?
Throughout.
This is the Chief's question, kind of.
Throughout the process of the summary judgment proceeding, it could have been. All the
which summary judgment proceeding? There's a number of them.
All four of them. Any one of them.
Okay.
Would have been a time for them to have done that. All they had to do was request the medical records, review them, and retain an expert. The problem is the expert that they retained in this case gave an opinion that the insurance company felt was going to be a basis to dispute it. And once that was rejected by the Department of Labor, it had to change course.
Does it matter that 62733 is itself, I think, authority for collateral attack or review on something that's already final? It contemplates upsetting the apple cart. So, and I say that with this in mind, the preclusion concepts like res judicata are there to prevent relitigation of issues once they've been settled in the interest of economy and certainty of results and expectations and all that sort of thing. This statute, however, seems like we have certain doctrines like this in other topical areas of the law that a judgment, in this case a policy judgment by the legislature, to account for changed conditions as if to sort of say, look, you know, the order you've got is fine, you can go with that, but here's authority to revisit that. If you like, you don't have to, but you can. How does that then reconcile with your preclusion argument?
The answer, Your Honor, is Hayes. And if you look at Hayes, in the conclusion of Hayes, there's a discussion of 62733 and how it applies. And there's an operative date in Hayes, and that's August 3rd, 2010. That's the date of the admission of the insurer in Hayes. And that was essentially the cutoff date. And if you go to the conclusion of Hayes, it talks about the insurer can bring a claim for 62733, but the change of condition has to occur after that operative date of August 3rd, 2010. In this case, we have multiple operative dates, but specifically let's use the contempt finding by Judge Davis as an operative date, December 29, 2016. There's no evidence that Mr. Wetch's condition has changed since December 29, 2016. And in fact, the insurer doesn't even contend that it has. Instead, it contends that Mr. Wetch's condition changed back in 2010, prior to making the admissions before the Department of Labor and Judge Davis.
Could you, in your remaining time, we're whittling down on it, and I'm sorry if I've taken too much of it. Could you talk about the causation standard and the causation issue that would apply? Let's say your alternative argument, let's say you don't win on mend the whole res judicata or equitable or judicial estoppel.
Very briefly, because this case is so old, the standard in 1991 is the Caldwell standard, which is any source of contribution. And in this case, there's substantial evidence provided by the insurer and its expert, Dr. Sabo, that this 2010 fall both aggravated Mr. Wetch's 1991 work injury condition and contributed to the injury. And specifically, if you look at Dr. Sabo's testimony in his report regarding the location of the injury. So in 1991, Mr. Wetch received a cervical fusion. And as a product of that cervical fusion, Dr. Sabo says that that fusion magnified the shearing forces at the segments above and below the neck that Dr. Sabo contends was injured in the 2010.
Did the Department of Labor address that argument? And I know that there's that last injurious exposure thing, but did which no one seems to, you know, think was right. But did the ALJ make findings on that shearing force theory from Dr. Siegel?
Well, the ALJ did reference the shearing force, but didn't recognize it as a source of contribution. And
your contribution argument is different than the natural consequences argument that appears in the briefs from that Barrett decision from our former colleague, Justice Zinner. The contribution argument seems to go back to the 62117 compensability causation standard from 1991. Am I right?
That's correct.
Why does it do that? Why wouldn't it just use Larson's test and play out the natural consequences?
I'm sorry, can you?
Yeah,
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So if we're talking about whether this intervening non-industrial, non-work injury is, and we're trying to determine, you know, whether the condition that results from that was caused in some way or has a causal relationship to the 91 injury, why don't we just apply Larson's test to seeking natural consequences?
Before you answer that, Shirley, do you want to add 5 minutes to each side's time? We've got the time to do that this morning. So we'll add 5 minutes to you.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
And then you'll get another five as well.
So whether you want it or not, you've got to have it.
Early if you want.
That's okay. So as I understand your question is why don't we just apply Larson's to the the non-industrial cause question. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah.
Okay. The reason is that we have testimony on an aggravation, and it's undisputed that we're dealing with an aggravation of a work injury. And this actually goes to the way that this issue has been presented under both 62447 and 62733, and it's a misnomer that we're looking at an injury from the perspective of 62447. The petition of Mr. Wetch is for compensation for a work injury in 1991, not for the 2010 fall. The question is, did the condition change as a result of the 2010 injury? It's injury versus condition. And the testimony has established, the substantial weight of testimony, is that there is a direct tie from both the 91 work injury to the 2010 fall. And so based on that testimony, Mr. Wetch contends that both the Department of Labor and the Circuit Court erred in finding a change of condition under 62733.
I have a question with regard to the aggravation part of it. So is it, you know, it appeared that the department's findings really were zeroed in on whether or not the fall itself could be, or the fall itself is the sole cause of the further injury, the aggravation, as opposed to whether or not, even if the fall itself was primarily, if not solely, caused by something other than the initial injury, is there still an argument that the injury that he suffered from that fall was still related to the prior injury, or the 1991? And was that presented clearly to the department, and how did that play out?
If I understand your question correctly, it is there any issue about whether the 2010 fall had a causal connection to the 1991 work injury?
The injury, not just the fall.
The fall.
See what I'm saying?
I do, okay. I understand, thank you. yes, there's substantial testimony that was provided to the Department of Labor with respect to the propensity of Mr. Wetch to fall as a result of the spastic quadriparesis that he suffered in the 1991 work injury. In fact, it was undisputed by the experts that testified in this case. And it was a basis of error that the circuit court identified by the Department of Labor in concluding that the 1991 work injury did not cause Mr. Wetch to have a propensity to fall or protect himself during a fall. And so there was substantial discussion of that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think, if I understand the department's finding, the issue was, you know, it seems like all the medical experts were saying, hey, this guy has a propensity to fall. I mean, it's more likely because of this and walks around with a cane. That's why he walks around with a cane. And so that all makes sense. My understanding is the department said, well, the door handle fell off when he went to reach it. So they make the inference and they say, well, he wouldn't have fallen, but the door handle falling off. Is that something we can interfere with? Is that clear error? For them to make that inference, even though you've got all this expert testimony over here saying this guy's more likely to fall, well, the door handle fell off, and that's what caused it.
So with respect to the findings of fact, that would require clear error, Your Honor. Is that your question?
Right. Yes. And so that does require clear error. So what I'm saying is, can we jump in and say, hey, the door handle fell off, they made an inference that's what caused the injury, even though he's got a more likelihood of falling, can we interfere with that on a clear error standard?
If the substantial weight of evidence leaves the court with the firm conviction that a mistake has been made, Your Honor. And Mr. Wetch would submit that there is substantial evidence of that and that it was error for the Department of Labor and the Circuit Court to find a change in condition as a result. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McLeay, you may proceed with the argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel, my name is Bart McLeay, and along with me, Mr. T.J. Von Wald and Suzanne Sheehan are my co-counsel for the appellee, Crum & Forster Commercial Insurance. This appeal, Your Honor, presents an opportunity to address the workman's compensation bargain in South Dakota, which of course aims to support workers, but it also must have safeguards to ensure the system is sustainable for future workers as well. This case concerns a major accident involving a dangerously defective fire door handle that tragically caused Mr. Wetch to suffer new and serious injuries 2 decades after he had a work injury for which he was no longer seeking any medical treatment for 3 years at the time of the April 2010 fall.
Mr. McLeay, can I ask you a question just sort of figure out at this moment in time in the generation of litigation that precedes us here, sort of where we're at, and I'll help you maybe with these questions. So I talked to Mr. Oviatt, we've got the 2014 petition, right? And that seems to be, you know, maybe not finished at this point. But then we have, in addition, the administrative request made in whatever, 2020, by the insurer under 62733. Does that seem right?
Very close, yes, Your Honor.
So those are, if you will, the two administrative actions that are out there.
Right.
There's no others.
Correct.
And the one that we're reviewing is the adverse decision to Mr. Wetch in the 62733 action.
And
request.
62-4-47 as well.
Although, well, that was part of it, but it's not part of it on appeal, it doesn't look like.
If you say, we have argued that was the issue for us, that was a primary issue for us to bring the case, was under 447, but 63733, absolutely.
But you lost on that, and there's no notice of review seeking the 62447 determination.
I wasn't aware that we lost it. They actually didn't raise the argument, and therefore we contended that they've waived it. They've waived that argument. But
on the fraud issue.
Well, and the 62447 actually has 2 parts. One is that there were fraudulent conditions, and separate from that, that the injury here did not arise out of or relate to the work.
Fair to say that's not part of this appeal?
We'd say it is a part of the appeal, Your Honor, that that argument was simply waived. We'd argue that it's a part of the appeal unless they've been declared to have waived it. That was an issue that we prevailed on below, and we're hoping that is now going to be, it is final if they've waived it.
Okay. Well, I don't see argument on that issue when I read the briefs. Maybe I'm missing. I mean, I see the argument you made about the connection arise out of the employment, but what I was really driving at is the 2014 petition that's open yet, is that the subject of your request to vacate those prior determinations, those prior summary judgments?
The answer to your question is the petition is open and therefore it's never been final, right. And those motions for partial summary judgment are sitting there, and we did make a request to vacate those now that this decision has been made, and that was put in abeyance, if you will.
That also is not part of this appeal.
Correct, not at this point.
So your view is that this reopens everything back to 2010?
Yes, Your Honor. What it does is, because in the partial summary judgments, for example, that were entered in this case, they were clearly interlocutory in nature. They were clearly things that could change. So if you look at the nature of the partial summary judgments, they were for things like, we want you to give medication this way, we want the vehicle to have hand controls. These are very specific orders of a medical regimen. And in that particular instance, those things could change. If those, in fact, were as final orders as were recommended by Mr. Wetch's counsel, those would be up on appeal, being considered, and at the same time, by this court or the circuit court, and at the same time, they may be changed down below. Doctors may be saying, we don't want soma medication anymore. And in this case, Mr. Wetch, it turned out, wasn't able to use hand controls. So we'd be using judicial resources on appeal if those kind of orders were in fact final. It doesn't mean that the orders didn't need to be followed. I'm not saying that. What I am saying, however, is that the partial summary judgments were not final orders, and therefore there was no finality there at all.
So that will be the subject. I'm sorry to interrupt, sorry to take time with this, but I want to nail this down if I can, because it's the only time we have to talk. So if you win, then your motions to vacate go, and you would assume you would litigate those later.
We would assume, yes, that those would be
Be the plan. So here's my question, though, is, and no one's mentioned it, and I don't want to make a big deal, I guess, I don't know, but it seems like the 62733 proceeding is unfinished. The statute contemplates a determination of changed conditions, but it also contemplates additional action to increase, eliminate, decrease, whatever's warranted. That didn't happen. We have only the change in conditions. Everyone's kind of treated that like a final order, and maybe it is, and I'll acknowledge that that's not really raised, but as I look at the statute and everything that it contemplates and the order of operations that it seems to suggest, we've really only done half of it.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that we have reached a final order on that case. That, to me, this is very similar to what happened in this court's decision in Call versus Benevolent. In that particular case, there was a finding and a conclusion on total disability, and the department had ruled there was a total disability. And then then said, we're going to go continue jurisdiction for partial disability. And the employer there objected and said, no, we object to that. But importantly in that case, the total disability order was deemed final because there really was nothing to turn back on. Unlike my examples of partial orders dealing with medications and medical treatment, so there can be final orders in a case. And this type of order that was entered here, that there is going to be a termination or modification of benefits due to a change of condition, would be a final order.
So when does that get? When does the rest of the 33 proceeding finish? When does the department figure out whether something gets diminished or ended or whatever? When does that happen?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if there has been an appeal from the final order here that was entered on the 2010 fall injury. That was a final order. They have appealed, and as soon as that appeal is done, we will probably have to address that before the department. But we do say, as I mentioned before, that we think that there was a termination or modification under 62447 as well, and that will have to be addressed as well. It's really a similar question, but the point is that it wasn't addressed, but this was a final order.
You know, it kind of seems like it's kind of being done on the installment plan a little bit. As I look at it, and I haven't lived with it as long as you all have, but...
Well, I want to address something about that I think was asked about the timing here and how the insurer came to this decision and when it did, if that would be okay. You know, there was, we before the April 2010 fall, there were 3 years of no contact, even reaching out by the insurance company, but no contact from Mr. Wetch, no seeking of any medical benefits. Under a prior statute, that would have built a presumption in that there was no medical treatment and the injury was healed. So by April 2010, there was virtually no contact. In August of 2011, Dr. Goodhope, who was then the treating physician, said, hey, there are some medical treatments that need to be done here arising out of the 1991 injury. Now, we might have had questions about that, but this was the treating physician of his patient and saying this, that it arose out of the 1991 injury. We know now that Dr. Goodhope, many years later, did not know about the April 2010 fall, nor did we, nor did Dr. Wojciechowski, who did the IME. None of the doctors knew. And they had said, well, it must be arising out of the 1991 injury. Dr. Goodhope much later said, I cannot say any more, and this is in Judge Faw's ruling, I cannot say any more that there was a contribution of the 1991 injury into the current medical condition of Mr. Wetch. And that established that this was a brand new, distinct injury. It was new and unique. And it was significant. I know there were some questions asked about.
Can I ask you, though, if I read everything correctly and to the extent that I understand it, there's really no dispute that Mr. Wetch was more susceptible to falling as a result of the original worker's injury, correct?
Correct.
So what did the department then rely on when it found that the 1991 injury and the propensity to fall did not in any way contribute to the 2010 fall?
Your Honor, this could be likened to an accident that could have been a car accident, or it could have been Mr. Wetch walking outside, falling accidentally into a sinkhole. The falling, the propensity to fall did not have anything to do with the outcome. And both Judge Foss said that, and then later the Circuit Judge Northup said that as well, that the propensity to fall isn't what happened. It was so abrupt. This is a
what,
great...
But what did they rely on, though? I mean, if somebody, and maybe I'm not understanding this, but if somebody has a propensity to fall as a result of a prior injury, which is not contested in this case, as I understand, what did they rely on for the proposition that the fall was not somehow contributed to or caused by the propensity?
Your Honor, this is a very thick steel fire door. Any of us practically have been at the top of that. When you'd see a fire door in front of you, and you got to imagine Mr. Wetch would have opened this door a lot, but you get that fire door, you're gonna pull hard. You're gonna give a big pull, and you're gonna pull, and you're gonna fall back. We had a Dr. Liebscher is an expert, decades of experience in analyzing these kind of accidents, and that's what he found. When the forces and acceleration that occurred by virtue of Mr. Wetch pulling on that doorknob in anticipation of trying to pull open a fire door, that's all that was needed. That catapulted him down the back of the stairs, hit the sheetrock so hard with his head that it was the size of a soccer ball. That's how Dr. Liebscher knew the speed by which he took off. This is more akin to some other cases of intervening cause where somebody who might have had other disabilities, but they're sitting in a car and they're hit in an accident and they get injured, has nothing to do with their propensity, whether it's to fall or anything else. This had to do, and that was found by the department.
Go ahead.
So in your scenario, the car accident, so my question, this was a question I asked for opposing counsel. I'm not sure it was answered, but so when you have those scenarios, in what I'm trying to figure out is there's these findings about aggravation of the injury that the department made with regard to both experts. So is there, let's say in the car accident, obviously the prior injury had nothing to do with the car accident, but is the condition that the claimant was left in as a result of the earlier injury, does that make is there still some causal connection with the injury that is suffered after the independent intervening injury that still makes the claim compensable? That's what I'm wondering. And what is, because it seems like that was one of the arguments that is at least being made on appeal, that the aggravation finding of the underlying injury could still be a causal connection here.
I think that's an excellent question. I will say it this way. I know this court in Grawl said there's a difference between injury and condition, and they've also you've also said that the contribution has to be to the injury. So the work contribution, the 1991 work injury, has to be a contribution to the work has to be a contribution to the injury itself. And in this particular case, and the intervening cause that was in existence in 1991 through this court's decision in Henson, intervening cause says that if there is something that there's an injury that is not a direct or natural result or consequence of the prior injury, then it's an intervening cause that essentially supersedes the prior injury. And in this case, in an aggravation, it can be the injury can be aggravated by the new incident, or it can be a plainly new incident that doesn't aggravate the old injury, but is significant. In either case, those are both intervening causes under the jurisprudence of this court. So I would say to you that regardless of what his condition was at the end, the fact is they have to prove that the 1991 work itself contributed as a cause to the current injury. As an injury. So the work has to contribute to the injury. In this case, the 1991 injury is not contributing to the medical condition today. That's what Judge Faw, the medical expert, said.
So now you just used injury and condition two different ways. So that's my question. So there is an argument here that his injuries would not have been as severe had it not been for the 1991 injury, citing Dr. Sabo's testimony that there is increased force above and below the fusion site. I'm not sure the Department of Labor made any findings as it relates to that.
I think the Department of Labor decided that whether there was an adjacent syndrome.
This is different than adjacent segment disease. They made that motion, that argument as well, but I read maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you have a different view about that. I shouldn't talk you into it. But I read it as there's a different injury. This is an eggshell plaintiff type person that is susceptible to having more severe injuries from this injury, and more severe as a result of the condition that they have as following the 1991 work injury.
I think Judge Faw and I think the Circuit Court affirmed on this that wasn't the case here, though. What the case here was, you could have an eggshell plaintiff get in a car accident and have severe medical conditions as a result of that, and the fact that they were had propensities to fall or had other propensities that were make them an eggshell plaintiff doesn't change anything. It's the incident involving the fall that created all of the medical conditions, the C2-3 spinal injury, the C5-6 spinal injury, those in very significant operations that took place as a result, all on account of the 2010 fall. It wasn't on account of any underlying propensity or underlying injury. The 1991 injury, as I'll say again, for over 3 years, there had been no medical treatment sought, no medical treatment given for Mr. Wetch up until the 2010 fall.
You keep using propensity, because we have propensity to fall, but this is about susceptibility to re-injury or susceptibility to a different injury as a result of the fusion. Did the administrative law judge, in your mind, address that issue?
Well, I think
make findings about it.
I think that the findings were maybe somewhat by omission, I suppose, because the finding was is that this the incident involved here, the 2010 fall. And the way it occurred, the susceptibility of Mr. Wetch to anything wouldn't have mattered in this instance. The injuries that resulted from that are all the medical treatment that was given to him after that. That all related to the 2010 fall. And his susceptibility for one thing or another didn't matter. It was yanking on that fire door handle that threw him back in a very, very strong way that is what caused his injury. His susceptibilities were not impacted.
So Dr. Sabo, and there is a finding on this, Dr. Sabo says that the 1991 fusion magnified the shearing force. That's that shearing force that comes up testimony quite a bit. At the spinal sections above and below the finding, that's the aggravation that he talked about. So it magnifies the force.
which is to say it wouldn't be magnified if he wouldn't have had the fusion.
Well,
so that just that's doesn't matter as it relates to the causation analysis here.
I think that if you have an injury that constitutes an intervening cause, which this does, if you have an injury of that magnitude and it might impact something else, the shearing forces weren't at the problem for him to fall, or it wasn't the problem of the doorknob, it wasn't a problem for what happened to him neurologically. None of that made any difference. The shearing forces might have been impacted, just like anything else on him might have been impacted by this very significant intervening cause.
So just one more before we get off of that. So the language used in the Larson's text refers to an independent intervening cause attributable to a claimant's own intentional conduct.
Yeah.
And then we have, this was a circuit court memorandum opinion by former Justice Steve Zinner that was relied upon and used as a source to persuade the department and the circuit court as to how we analyze the situation, that also referred to the intervening cause being something that didn't intentional use that term, but a negligent type conduct. And that kind of goes with sort of the eggshell claimant sort of theory that, they are more susceptible because of the initial injury. And if they're just living their life regularly, not doing anything that they shouldn't be doing, and then they have an injury. And again, I get it. It still goes back to your medical, argument that the new injuries were not related. But does that come into play, too, the intentional conduct or negligent conduct of the claimant?
Larson's had two subsections, 13.00 and 13.11. 13.00, which deals with the intentional conduct, that was not in even existence in 1991. However, the 13.11 is the section applicable here, the one which says that when the work is no longer compensable if the worsening of the condition is produced by an independent non-industrial cause. That is the section that's applicable to this case. There are other sections about not allowing claimants to go skydiving or base jumping or things like that that would say, well, then you are creating your own condition. That is not this case. This case was simply about a very defective door handle and an insurance and an apartment manager that should have been responsible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClain. Mr. Oviatt, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I want to begin with Justice Salter's question about 62733 and whether more proceedings need to occur as a result of the Department of Labor's findings. I think this is this exemplifies the perversion of the judicial machinery that Hayes talks about, because we have a 94 settlement agreement that establishes that Mr. Wetch is permanently and totally disabled. Some of his condition must be caused by the 1991 work injury because it's permanent by nature. And yet we have this finding by the Department of Labor that that condition no longer remains the cause of his condition. Those two positions don't make sense together because his condition from 1991 is permanent. With respect to Dr. Goodhope's testimony, and I understand counsel's characterization of it, and I understand the Department of Labor's finding with respect to it. However, that was presented by deposition testimony, which is freely reviewable by this court, and as it was reviewable by Judge Viken during the federal court proceeding. And Judge Viken took a very different view of Dr. Goodhope's testimony than what has been characterized here today. Judge Viken agreed that there may have been some qualification of Dr. Goodhope's testimony with respect to causation and the contribution of the 1990 work injury and his propensity to fall and his current condition, but he still maintained that it was the cause of his current condition.
So if you lose in this case, and then what? Then there has to be more, there has to be additional proceedings in front of the department to determine the rest of the 62733 analysis, whether it's eliminating it, reducing the benefit, whatever is warranted?
And if so, what? How does that differ from the medical record that already existed with all of the treating physicians and experts that had testified before?
So your question is essentially, isn't this, are we going to have the same hearing over again, effectively?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's the end of it. It doesn't seem like it's the end of the 62733 proceeding. It seems like there's more. It's a big part of it. It's the changed condition, but the whole purpose for someone seeking it, whether it's the employee or whether it's the insurer, is to seek a change in the benefits, increase, decrease, eliminate, whatever's warranted, and that's the textual provision, whatever's warranted. So when does that happen, and what kind of evidence do we have for that, or does the department have for that, and is it different than what you anticipate what we had here? I'm trying to visualize
it.
We don't do
question.
These cases every day, and I'm kind of trying to figure it out.
It's not a situation that I've ever been able to identify in any of the previous case law. There doesn't appear to be any statute beyond 62733 that discusses it. And so it does sort of put us into a gray area that we'll be charting new territory for. But yes, I think the answer to your question is we would have to have a subsequent hearing on what specific medical benefits may be related to the 2010 fall or the 1991 work injury. And there would have to be apportionment of those on some basis. But by and large, you're correct that the testimony is more or less going to be the same. The next issue that I wanted to talk about just very quickly was with respect to the admissions of the insurer during the pendency of the summary judgment proceedings. And that was a question with respect to the finality that I think it was Justice Salter was asking about. And this court's decision in Sconesburg versus Menard talks about an admission by a litigant, in specific a carrier, who will pay the benefits that are in dispute. And in Sconesburg, the workers' compensation claimant was attempting to file a motion for summary judgment on the payment of benefits, and the insurer came in and said, hey, you know, we've already paid these. And despite that, the Department of Labor entered summary judgment. And this court said, once the payment of benefits has been made, the issue's moot, and jurisdiction has been deprived. And that goes back to the jurisdictional question that we were talking about with respect to res judicata and mend the hold.
Res judicata is actually not jurisdictional.
I'm sorry?
Res judicata is a prudential doctrine. So it's not really jurisdictional, but I mean, I understand. I don't want to pick a nit, but...
I meant to say the Sconesburg mootness argument. Lastly, with respect to the susceptibility versus propensity discussion that, well, frankly, everyone was having, I think Justice Myron hit it right on the head. That what we're talking about is effectively an eggshell plaintiff, that the testimony of Dr. Sabo was that Mr. Wetch had a propensity for injury and that the shearing forces during this fall were increased by that work injury fusion. And because we're talking about the 1991 work injury, we're talking about just a very small, minute source of contribution as opposed to a major contributing cause. Justice Salter's question about whether there was a finding, you identified it, that there was, in fact, a finding by the department. There was no analysis or application of that finding by the Department of Labor or the Circuit Court. It was just a finding that was sort of hanging out there that didn't appear to resonate with the Department of Labor as a significant piece of evidence, but it was. It was critical because it established that it was undisputed that Mr. Wetch was an eggshell plaintiff, that but for that 1991 work injury and that fusion that resulted in it, the injury to his neck would not have been as severe. The shearing forces would not have been magnified. And so that's the source of contribution that Caldwell requires. And if there are no additional questions, I've received an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal, and I will ask the court to please reverse. Mr. Wetch respectfully requests the court reverse the Department of Labor and the Circuit Court's conclusion with respect to res judicata, amend the hold and judicial estoppel, and reverse the Circuit Court's conclusion that there was a change of condition pursuant to 62-7-33. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess.